Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, a host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Great Lakes hold 20% of the world's supply of surface fresh water and provide sustenance, work, and recreation for tens of millions of Americans. But they are under a threat as never before, and their problems are spreading across the continent. This morning, we continue our discussion about the Great Lakes, which we began in early May. This week, we explore the waves of invasive species, particularly zebra and quagga mussels, that not only wreak havoc in the Great Lakes, but now threaten places far away from the middle of North America, like the Colorado River system. My guest is Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, it's good to be back.
I wanted to start by just kind of summarizing for those people who didn't hear the show in May or forgot what they heard, just why the Great Lakes has been isolated until the last few hundred years from the rest of the world's ecosystems and why it's been so vulnerable to invasive species.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, the Great Lakes, there's five of them, Huron, Michigan, Superior, Erie, and Ontario, and they make up the world's largest freshwater system. They collectively hold about 20% of the world's surface freshwater. And historically, vast as they are, they were isolated from the rest of the aquatic world, almost like a pond in the middle of the forest. And that's because on the eastern end, there was no way anything could get into the lakes due to the roaring outflow of the lakes, which is the St. Lawrence River. And that runs from Lake Ontario out to the ocean. And then between Lake Ontario and Lake Erie is Niagara Falls, which was even a bigger obstacle for anything to migrate its way into the system. And on the western end, they were protected by what hydrologists call a subcontinental divide, but it's basically a continental divide, and it's not as dramatic as the Rocky Mountains. It's in some places just a subtle bump in the landscape, but this watershed divide separated the Great Lakes from the waters of the Mississippi River Basin, which spans about 40% of the continental United States. So there was no way anything could, you know, naturally migrate in and out. Of course, there's always ways for species to move. You know, they could, you know, attach to birds' feet or feathers, but that's a slow process that, you know, takes place on almost a geological scale when you think about the changing cast of characters in the lakes. But this isolation was destroyed beginning in the 1800s with a series of navigation projects to link the Great Lakes to the outside world. So that's we like to talk about it as the Great Lakes front door, and that would be the St. Lawrence Seaway, which offers ocean-sized or freighter-sized boats to come up from the East Coast, from anywhere in the world, into the lakes. And it's a canal and lock system that skirts the once roaring St. Lawrence River as well as Niagara Falls. And then on the western end, we destroyed the subcontinental divide with the construction of the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, which is probably of particular interest to your readers because that's how several species, significantly quagga and zebra mussels, made their way out of the lakes into, you know, the heart of the continent. And it was just a matter of time before those species made their way over the Rocky Mountains, presumably towed by a recreational boater. And the first quagga mussel was discovered in Lake Mead, I believe, in 2007. It might have been 2009. I can't remember. And they've been spreading like a cancer ever since. And,
actually, I want to back up a little bit because I want to talk about how the quagga mussels and the zebra mussels actually got into the Great Lakes to begin with. So let's talk about the front door again before we start talking about the back door.
Sure.
So how did they get there?
Well, they got here in, the first one was discovered in 1988, but then they subsequently determined that an unidentified mussel discovered in Lake Erie in 1986 was the first one. And they arrived as hitchhikers aboard an overseas freighter. The mussels are native to the Ponto-Caspian Basin, just basically the Black and Caspian Sea basins. And like North America, Europe's been heavily plumbed with canal systems. So they made their way into Western Europe from the Ponto-Caspian. And then from there, it was a freighter ride across the Atlantic, up the St. Lawrence Seaway, and into the Great Lakes. And they came in in freighter ballast tank, and ballast tanks are used to balance an otherwise unevenly loaded freighter, or to just, you know, if the freighter has no cargo, to stabilize it so it can plow through the water in a safe manner. They're not meant to bounce around like a cork on the open seas. So, well, for centuries, ballast was solid material. It was sand or bricks or you know, iron. But as boats got bigger, that just became too intense of a process to load and unload all that solid material. So engineers started using water, because at about 8 pounds a gallon, I believe, it's suitably heavy to serve as ballast, and it can be easily pumped on and off board. So one of these freighters can carry millions of gallons of ballast, and the problem with this is that, unlike, say, sand, it's not dead weight. It can be anything but. It can contain anything that, you know, may be lurking in a port where the ballast water is taken on. So that's how zebra and quagga mussels made their way over. And, you know, it was like most discoveries, it was, you know, started with one specimen, and it was only a matter of months before they were finding them by the millions. And today they can be found in the lake by the quadrillions, and they've really fundamentally changed the way the Great Lakes function.
What is so devastating about quagga mussels and zebra mussels compared to, like, last time we talked about the alewives and the lamprey? What makes this particular invasive species so invasive?
Okay, well, yeah, not to backtrack and talk about everything that we talked about previously, but the lamprey invasion of the 1920s and 30s and 40s of the Great Lakes really basically took out the top of the food chain. Lampreys are eel-like fish, and they're parasitic. They don't swallow their prey. They attach themselves to larger fish, and just like a vampire, just sucks the blood out of them. And they made short work of the Great Lakes' top predator, which was lake trout, and with nothing at the top of the food chain, everything below it was unchecked. And unfortunately for the Great Lakes, behind the lampreys came another invader, and that was the alewives. And so these species didn't get deposited in the lakes by ocean-going freighters. They swam their way in. And with nothing to keep alewives in check, they're too small to fall prey to the lampreys. They just exploded and, you know, made a mess of the Great Lakes that wasn't fixed until we started importing Pacific salmon from Oregon, actually, back in the 1960s. Anyway, that was a case where, if you want to look at it in simple terms, the top of the food chain was taken out, the lake trout, and everything below it kind of... suffer wouldn't be the right word, because it actually did very well, but it wasn't good for the balance of the lakes. The problem with these zebra and quagga mussels is they've attacked the food chain from a more vulnerable point, and that's the bottom. They're filter feeders, and each one of these little fingernail-sized mollusks can filter a liter of water a day, and when you have trillions and now quadrillions of these things, that means that the lakes are being filtered. They're just having the life sucked out of them. And so, you know, it's been estimated that at times of year, plankton levels, at important times of year in the spring, plankton levels on, for example, Lake Michigan are 10% of what they were. So the bigger fish are now starving, because the little fish that also depend on the plankton aren't getting enough to eat. So they're starting to, if not disappear, their numbers are shrinking, and so their conditions are suffering. So that's one big impact of the mussels, and, you know, that is having and will have significant impacts on fisheries out west. But equally important are what the mussels do to water intakes, and basically any kind of man-made system that moves water. They plug up pipes. They find pipes great habitat, because they can just sit there attached to the side and just suck all that water rushing past for the plankton in it, and they end up gumming up waterworks a lot like plaque in an artery. And so, you know, they've been in a nonstop battle to keep the water cooling systems at Hoover Dam muscle-free since they were first discovered in Lake Mead, you know, about a decade ago. And they've just been spreading. You know, they can't really swim, their muscles, but they do have a life stage right after they are hatched where they float on currents. So it was really difficult to stop the spread of mussels anywhere downstream on the Colorado River system from Lake Mead because they could just drift on currents. Fortunately, they can also hitch rides just, you know, on recreational boats. They can live out of water for days. And so you get somebody, you know, going down to Lake Mead to, you know, have a weekend on the water, and then the next weekend they go to Lake Powell, and, you know, they've still got, you know, wet engines or you know, contaminated bilge water, and then, you know, another invasion gets launched. So they've just been kind of inexorably marching their way across the West, and as I understand it, I haven't checked the maps recently, but they're still not up in the Columbia and Snake River system.
Yeah, so I understand. Actually, I spent a lot of time down the Colorado River in the early part of the century and did a big tour of Hoover Dam. And it was interesting when I was reading your book and realizing how different the landscape was there like 5 years after the last time I was there, because I was there before the mussel invasion, and it's a whole other world. And I know I spent enough time in California, there's signs everywhere about you have to get your boat sanitized when you enter the state, and there's the huge effort to try to reduce the hitchhiking that happens. I'm wondering, well, first of all, I wanted to kind of get back to how those mussels got out of Lake Erie or out of the Great Lakes and all the way to Lake Mead and then ultimately to Lake Powell. Was it just on boats, or was there also other waterways that they were able to follow to get closer to Arizona and New Mexico, Nevada and Utah?
Well, no. I mean, so they can naturally migrate. So with the talking about the front door and the back door is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, and that project, which opened in 1900, was really just it still is today, is a big flush of Lake Michigan water into a canal that runs into a river that feeds into the Mississippi River Basin, and Chicago built this canal so they could discharge their sewage away from their drinking water intakes on Lake Michigan and into the Mississippi River Basin. The problem is you know, it also opened up the door for all sorts of species to migrate between the once separated ecosystems. So mussels can drift, you know, they drift on currents, as I mentioned earlier, so it was only a matter of time till they'd make their way all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. But they could also go north and east and west by just attaching to boat hulls and riding up these vessels up and down the system like elevators. And so I think the last count is they're in 22 states or something like that. But they couldn't make their way naturally on their own over the Rocky Mountains. So, you know, somewhere, somebody probably from, say, Nebraska or Missouri or someplace, dragged their boat over the Rockies and into Lake Mead, and that's how the invasion was launched.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Egan, who's the author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and we're talking about the waves of invasive species that have hit the Great Lakes since it was opened to the rest of the world. Kind of reminds me of when they opened Japan back in the 19th century, and what happens when you do that. And we're also looking at the impact that these invasive species are having on the rest of the continent. Now, do the quagga mussels and zebra mussels have any natural predators?
Yeah, in their native ecosystem they do. You know, they're not a menace. Just, you know, this is so often the story of invasive species. It's, you know, you can't fault these organisms. They're just doing what they do, and you know, when they evolve in a balanced system, they're just a player, not a dominant player. So in the Ponto Caspian region, they were fed on by all manner of things. Significantly, they're favored in the diet of a fish called the round goby, which initially, unfortunately, I guess, also made its way into the Great Lakes. They, you know, they came from the same place as the mussels, and they came the same way aboard an overseas freighter. And gobies are now thriving in the Great Lakes, and they're doing so by eating mussels, which most native species in the Great Lakes can't eat. But there's never going to be enough gobies to significantly reduce the number of mussels out in the lakes. I mean, just to give you an idea of how significant the problem is and how densely these mussels cluster and the areas they cover, I could walk, if I got out about a half a mile from the shore of Lake Michigan, which I'm looking at right now, the mussels won't attach right up along the beach because the wave action keeps them from getting a foothold. But you get a little bit deeper, farther out into the lake, say a quarter mile or a half mile, you'll find a bed of quagga mussels. And it's 80 miles across from where I am to Muskegon, Michigan. And, you know, it looks like the ocean. You can't see 80 miles across the water. It's just this endless expanse. But if you were to drain that lake, I could walk from Milwaukee to Muskegon on a bed of quagga mussels.
It'd be kind of painful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if I had hiking boots, yeah, it'd be crunchy. But they cluster at densities, you know, up to 100,000 per square meter. And so, as I said earlier, they're like fingernail size. So you may think, how could 100,000 fit in a 3 by 3 foot square? Well, they don't just mother the bottom on one level. They cluster on top of each other, kind of like a coral. And so it's just this black, gnarly mess that just smothers the bottom of the lake and is constantly filtering it. And, you know, the lakes look spectacular today. If you were to fly over them, you know, people are always remarking on how gorgeous they are. They're kind of like a cobalt, just an intense blue. It's like the Caribbean. But that's not the sign of a healthy Great Lake. A healthy Great Lake is more of a green, brothy kind of situation. And so what they're doing is literally sucking the life out of it. And it comes with all sorts of consequences, not just for the fishery and not just for pipes. I could talk to you about all the different ways they're messing with the energy flow, and sometimes with very, very dangerous and expensive consequences.
What do you mean by messing? What do you mean by messing with the energy flow?
Okay, so I'll give you two examples. All right. So the mussels are making the lake so clear, they've allowed this explosion of a bottom-growing type of algae called Cladophora, and it's native to the Great Lakes. And Cladophora needs three things to thrive. It needs sunlight, it needs a hard surface to attach to, and it needs something to feed it. It needs nutrients. And the mussels provide all three. Because the lakes are so much clearer, which doesn't mean cleaner, but they are clearer than they had been historically, this Cladophora can grow in areas where it never could before because the sunlight penetrates so deeply. Then the mussels provide a surface upon which this stuff can grow because a lot of the lakes are sand bottom or clay bottom. There's rocky areas too, and that's where it was restricted to before the mussels. But now the mussels, particularly quagga mussels, they can thrive on a clay bottom. And so upon the backs of these mussels grows this algae, and then they further enhance its growth by with their excrement. Just, you know, they're kicking out a lot of nutrition for this algae. So you get these huge, I mean, fields isn't the word. I don't know how you would describe it. Just these vast swaths of lake bottom that are covered with this Cladophora, which is growing on top of the mussels. Well, and eventually that stuff dies, okay, as it decomposes, it burns up lots of oxygen and creates an oxygen-deprived or anaerobic environment, and that's where botulism could thrive. So in this oxygen-depleted environment, this toxin is this bacteria is now doing really well, and the mussels, which are immune to it, they suck it up, and you know, it doesn't affect them. But then here come the gobies, and the gobies, you can't make this stuff up. The gobies come along and they eat the mussels, and then they get poisoned. They get botulism, and so they get paralyzed, and they float to the surface and are an easy meal for all manner of birds, loons, ducks, what you name it. And and then those birds come down and gobble this up, and then they get poisoned with botulism too. And we've got like, you know, tens of thousands of birds dying on the eastern shore of Lake Michigan from botulism. And so that's just an example of, you know, how it's not just a changing in the name of what's living in the lakes, it's changing the way energy flows through it. Here's another example. Okay, these mussels filter, as I said, you know, a liter of water a day, and they basically strip all the nutrition that there is out of the water column. These are brainless little things, but they are smart enough not to eat a form of toxic algae called Microcystis. And you can see this on YouTube. You can go Google it and see. It's just a real short clip of a mussel sucking everything, you know, floating in an aquarium until it sucks in a certain fleck and it spits that out. And that's Microcystis. And that's a toxic type of algae. It's actually a cyanobacteria. And for humans, it's a liver toxin. So on Lake Erie now, with mussels being such a dominant player and Lake Erie being historically prone to algae outbreaks because of the amount of farm field surrounding the lake and the fact that it's shallower and warmer than the rest of the Great Lakes by a long way, Lake Erie has for a long time had an algae problem. But now today's algae problem is different because when you have an explosion of algae, which is driven by, you know, a lot of nutrients coming off the landscape, it's more likely to be an explosion of this toxic stuff. And in 2014, there was a big bloom of this, and it went right into the drinking water intake in Toledo. And all of a sudden, the drinking water supply for about 500,000 people turned poison, and you couldn't boil your way out of this problem, because that would only concentrate the toxins. So it only lasted 2 or 3 days, but they had to call in the National Guard, which rolled into town with emergency water purification system, pallets of water, baby formula, as far north as Ann Arbor, like an hour to the north, stores were out of bottled water by the time the sun rose when the boil order went out in the middle of the night. It was kind of a panicky situation. And so that's another example of, you know, just how problematic these invasive species can be, and be so in a manner that nobody can really predict until things start working together, and then you get trouble that,
hard
to fathom.
Is there any remedies that people have figured out to deal with this? Because it seems like this is like this exploding and snowballing array of invasive species and all kinds of problems created by them.
There's no way to well with these toxic algae blooms, you know, there we can address this. The only lever we can pull factor that we can change, the amount of phosphorus going into Lake Erie. And you know, I'm sure you remember back in the 1960s when Time magazine was calling, referring to Lake Erie as America's Dead Sea. That was because of algae outbreaks. It wasn't Microcystis, but it was a whole assemblage of different species. And scientists got together and realized that they were overdosing the lake with phosphorus, and that led to an agreement between the U.S. and Canada to dramatically reduce the amount of phosphorus going into the lakes, and that led to, you know, billions of dollars spent on sewage treatment upgrades, and then essentially the elimination of phosphorus-based laundry detergents. But just like the scientists predicted, they cut the flow of phosphorus, I think it was about in half, into the lake, and that was in the early 1970s, and by 1985, there's actually a funny story about this. In the original Lorax, Dr. Seuss took a crack at Lake Erie. There's some line where he's like, you know, there's a place where fish walk on water because it's so smeary. I hear things are just as bad up in Lake Erie. And that came out in 71 or 72. And by 85, the improvements were so dramatic on the lake that some Ohio State researchers wrote Dr. Seuss and said, hey, you got to take that line out of the Lorax. Lake Erie's doing well. And he did. He pulled it out and recognized that, you know, the Dead Sea was no longer so dead, and was, you know, a real kind of triumphant moment for, you know, the virtues of modern pollution control. But now we have a problem again with algae, and this time it's the toxic stuff. And the reason is we're still, you know, below the phosphorus cap that they had prescribed for the lake back in the 1970s, but a different type of phosphorus is now going into the lake, and it's a dissolved form coming off of croplands. And it's problematic because, you know, if this, they apply it in early spring or in winter when you can get heavy equipment out onto the fields without making a mess of them. And if you get a really wet spring, all that stuff washes into the lake before the crops can take it up. So they're talking about a 40% reduction from today's phosphorus load into Lake Erie. If they can reach that target, they're confident that they can get these algae blooms, if not eliminated, down to a level that they can be managed, and a level where people don't have to worry about, you know, bad water coming out of their taps. They haven't gotten there yet. There's been a fair amount of resistance, and that's not surprising. But so that's one thing that, you know, we can address. But we're never going to be able to get rid of the mussels. We just have to live with them. As I mentioned earlier about these gobies, you know, getting botulism, that happens in kind of they're very isolated areas where this happens. Overall, the goby is turning out to be kind of a good thing because, as I mentioned earlier, they are nature built to eat the mussels, and anything that can figure out how to eat a goby in the Great Lakes is doing all right. And significantly and kind of remarkably, it's native species. And so you're seeing like a surge in native lake trout, walleye, and even whitefish. And whitefish aren't a piscivore. They're not a fish-eating fish, or they typically aren't. It's turning out that if it's starving to death or a goby, a whitefish will try to eat a goby, and the commercial fishermen are saying they see these whitefish coming in with their mouths ripped open from trying to get them around, you know, a whole fish. They don't have teeth. They're not built to eat fish, but they're adapting. So you're kind of seeing evolution on the fly. So, you know, it's kind of a remarkable story that the top of the food chain is kind of stitching itself back together, even though the bottom of the food chain may look more like the Caspian Sea than the Great Lakes.
Well, if you're just tuning in, if you're just tuning in and talking this morning to Dan Egan, who's author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and we're talking about some of the major issues that have plagued the lakes for years in terms of invasive species that have spread around the country. And the last part of the show, I'm going to be going out with a very famous Randy Newman song. So I wanted to talk about why the Cuyahoga River was always catching on fire, and if that's an issue that has been resolved.
Okay, yeah, the Cuyahoga River is famous for catching fire on, it'll be 49 years ago this week, June 22nd, 1969. Is that 49? 48 years ago. It was a very famous fire, but what's curious is why it was famous, because the conventional wisdom is that, you know, things got so bad by the late 1960s that rivers were finally bursting into flames. And the reason it went caught on fire is because so many industries were just, they literally used the river as its sewer, as their sewer. And so they were discharging all manner of chemicals, some of them combustible. And on that morning, a train was going over the river that feeds Lake Erie, and a spark dropped, and the river spit back these flames that were 20 feet high. And, you know, they put it out pretty quickly, but news of it spread. And you know, I think one of the reasons, somebody in Cleveland was explaining to me, one of the reasons this became such a big deal is because it was in Time magazine, in the same issue as Edward Kennedy and Chappaquiddick. And so that was like the best-selling issue of Time, of all time, at that moment or at that period, and so people bought the magazine, and then buried in, you know, somewhere inside was this story about the Cuyahoga River catching fire. But what people don't understand is that wasn't the first time the river caught fire. As a matter of fact, that's the last time it caught fire. historical records show that the river was burning as early as the 1860s because of all the industrial excrements being dumped into it. But somewhere along the line, people finally said enough is enough, and out of the smoke from that fire came a lot of pressure to curb heavy industry polluting, and we got the Clean Water Act. I mean, there were many forces at play, but that was definitely a factor in it, and that led to dramatic pollution regulations that were expensive and initially resisted. But it's like, I like to think of it as like smoking on an airplane. People were all riled when was it, in the 80s, they banned smoking on an airplane. And now when you think about it today, I mean, it's just ludicrous, the idea that somebody could be sitting behind you blowing cigarette smoke in your face, and you're in the no smoking section, but you're still having to breathe this person's secondhand smoke. And we kind of had the same tolerance for industry to just put what it wanted into our waterways. And if they were to do that today, we would be aghast. But at the time, it was really resisted, and there was all sorts of worries that we were going to just go broke by throttling industry or saddling industry with all these pollution controls.
Let me just say,
it's also important to note that the Cuyahoga River wasn't the only river that caught fire. There are rivers all across the country that were burning, up until the 1960s. There was just something about that fire that grabbed people's attention. And the question now is, what's it going to take to get people to demand, similar protections for this other pollution that we've been talking about? And that's not industrial pollution, it's biological pollution, it's invasive species. And the big pathway for these things to get into the lakes is the St. Lawrence Seaway, and once they get into the lakes, they can go national, as you guys are learning. And so what's really interesting is to think about the door. This is front door that I'm talking about, literally is a door. The first lock on the St. Lawrence Seaway is at Montreal. It's called the St. Lambert Lock, and it's 80 feet wide, two doors. They swing open, and those are the doors to the continent. Sails in a ship carrying who knows what, and it gets into the Great Lakes, and then it's off to the races, and you guys are chasing down recreational boaters at, boat ramps all over Oregon and, the rest of the Northwest. And, once they're on the continent, they're going to spread. So the key is to keeping them off the continent.
Well, I know there's been a lot of work trying to restore the Great Lakes for a long time. I am currently reading Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money, and I'm reading the chapter right now about Richard Mellon Scaife, who, after the Clean Water, Clean Air Act and the EPA was created a family foundation and started funding all these efforts to curb the excesses of the liberal elite, as he saw them, who were trying to control industry. And now he's dead now, but his friends of his friends, Donald Trump, is in the White House, and I'm wondering what impact that's going to have on all the last 40, 50 years of regulations, environmental regulations that we've had. Are you hopeful that the efforts to continue to work on restoring the Great Lakes is going to be able to continue?
Yeah, I'm hopeful or optimistic, confident that it'll continue. Maybe not at the level that it has been for the last 7 years. But yeah, the Obama administration in 2010 started a program called the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And it was originally funded, I think, at over $400 million a year. But in recent years, it's been about $300 million a year. And it goes toward cleaning up some of the, legacy messes left over from the Clean Water Act days, cleaning up harbor sediments that, are laden with all manner of nasty stuff. But also how to into research on how to combat invasive species, and it's going toward wetland restoration and all sorts of projects that are bringing the lakes forward in a lot of ways as far as just their overall ecological health. And the Trump administration has proposed just zeroing that budget out, just eliminating it. And I think the reason that I'm optimistic that we're not going to get a big goose egg in federal dollars for Great Lakes Restoration Initiative programs in the next budget is because it isn't a partisan issue here, having a healthy Great Lakes ecosystem. We've lost tolerance for people blowing smoke in our faces on airlines, we've lost tolerance for industry to run roughshod over the lakes, and we've developed kind of an ethic that we need to go forwards rather than backwards. And eliminating this program would be a definite step backwards. And what's significant about this is that there's 8 Great Lakes states, and a number of them are key battleground states: Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. And those states are filled with people of all political stripes who value healthy lakes. And the Trump budget is just that's just his wish list, or his wish not list. it's Congress that's going to set the budget, and I just don't see this program, this very, very popular and necessary program, being eliminated.
Well, one of the things that I think about as somebody who lives in the Northwest, and before I lived in the Northwest many years ago, I lived in the Northeast, but I sort of bypassed the Great Lakes. I, as an environmental journalist, I've been following the Great Lakes to some degree. Your book has really been an eye-opener for me and taught me a lot of things that I had no idea about. I'm wondering how to get people around the country to understand that what's a problem in the Great Lakes is a problem for them wherever they live, and that they should be as engaged as people who live in the 8 Great Lakes states in restoring the ecological health and the vitality and economic vitality even of the Great Lakes.
Yeah, I hope this book demonstrates that invasive species in the Great Lakes is not just a Great Lakes problem, it's a national problem. And also, as I said at the beginning of the hour, the lakes hold 21 out of every 5 gallons of surface fresh water is right here in this relatively small geographic area. And, in this increasingly thirsty world, they're going to become more and more important. The question is, how are we going to manage them? And right now, there is significant restrictions on exporting water from the Great Lakes region to other areas of the country by pumping it out of the basin. But the pressure to do that is never going to go away, and it's probably only going to get stronger as we head deeper into this increasingly dry century, depending on where you are, dry century. It doesn't take a lot of water to have significant ecological impact. Water withdrawals have a significant ecological impact. So it'll be an interesting dynamic looking at, the states that are the thirstiest tend to be, the most populated and are growing the fastest. But as, we head deeper into the century, and with the impacts of climate change becoming manifest, maybe people will start looking at the Great Lakes as no longer the Rust Belt, but the Blue Belt. And, it's arguably easier to move water or people to water than water to people. So that's something to keep an eye on going forward. I think, we recognized these things as a treasure trove when we first discovered them, when whites first settled the area. They were just finding a hard time of finding the words to describe what they had seen. And somewhere along the line, we started taking them for granted, and I think that's changing, and I hope it is, and I think the future of the lakes depends on that, depends on people recognizing them as the ecological and economic trove that they are.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Stan, and for writing this book. It's been very inspiring for me to read, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to share it with my listeners. So again, thanks very much for being on Lucas Bookus.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking this morning with Dan Egan, who's author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. I want to just take a moment before we end the show to remember and to appreciate Thera Memory, a really amazing trumpeter, and even more important, music teacher and mentor for amazing musicians in this region for many, many years. And he died Saturday night, and it kind of saddens me to lose him. So I just wanted to spend a moment just remembering Thera Memory. Next week, my guests will be Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Tom Carpenter with Hanford Challenge. We're going to talk about the latest environmental catastrophes unfolding on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in eastern Washington, just 220 miles upstream from us here in Portland. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Randy Newman, Burn On Great River, about the Cuyahoga River catching fire in 1969. Thanks for listening.
red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. Cleveland, city of light, city of magic. Cleveland, city of light, you're calling me. Cleveland, even